welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Saturday, March 8th, 2025. It's just after 18 UTC as we are starting to record. I am Sam Minter. Yvon Bo is not with us this week. He messaged me actually a couple days ago at this point saying he was sick and he was feeling worse every day than the day before. And he had a lot of other stuff going on too, so he wasn't able to make it. So I put out my usual, hey, does anybody want to join us? And this time we have Ed. Hello, Ed. Welcome back to Curmudgeon's Corner.
Hello. It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. Oh, I should check my notes. Let's see when you were last here, Ed. You were last here on August 3rd, 2024.
My anniversary.
Oh, there you go. And so, I will mark that you are now here with us today. And
okay.
So anyway, we're going to have our usual sort of thing. We will talk about sort of less newsy stuff at the beginning of the show, and then we'll move on to more current events focused stuff as we progress. And as I usually do when we have a guest, I'm let the guest drive. So Ed will determine what topics he wants to talk about, and I will react and chat with him and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, Ed's going to drive. I will do my media review to start with. I have a movie. I have a movie to talk about. It'll be very exciting, I'm sure. So Ed, how do you want to start? First of all, I should just say, it's been since August that I talked to you. How you doing?
Pretty well, actually. We just got back Monday from a trip to India and Nepal.
Wow.
Which was a fantastic trip. Really had a ball until I came down with influenza the last 3 days of the trip.
And I've been good way to end.
I was almost over it, and then this morning when I woke up, I've got a sore throat, and I have a horrible feeling that I'm coming down with a strep throat. In addition to that, so if I start coughing or looking sick, I may have to step out for a minute. We'll see. But I already have an appointment with my primary doc next Monday for a routine visit. So I figure rather than going in and get a throat culture now, I'll just wait and have her check that Monday.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm feeling better than I did 4 days ago.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Yvon mentioned, I guess wherever he is, something's been going around and he got it. And so,
this has been a bad flu year for the whole nation. Even with a vaccine, I got the vaccine. I get it every year religiously. Mm-hmm. In some years, I get it twice. This year, I don't need it twice because I've got flu.
Nice. Yeah. No, I've lucked out so far this season. I haven't really had anything, I don't think. But of course, because I've said that, now I'm going to be like on my ass next week with something.
Well, it's been since COVID 5 years ago right now.
Yeah.
I have had two episodes of COVID, which were incredibly mild. I mean, I was for a day, I ran a temp of 99.5 and had a little sore throat and then was well. I have not had anything else, no colds, no flus or anything. So I was really spoiled. And of course, I let my guard down on the trip and didn't wear my mask all the time. So I'm paying for being stupid.
Well, there you go. So do you have something else in mind for this beginning, or do you want to talk about your trip?
I could talk about the trip a little bit. This is one of the companies that specializes in working with alumni associations. So the members, the tour group, were all people associated with the University of Chicago as alumni or spouses of alumni. So it was right off the bat, it was kind of fun because we had some fairly common denominators. Three of us were doctors, several lawyers, and then various other people in the group. But the trip itself was, I've never been anywhere quite like India. I've been in lots of crowded places. It was fascinating. They have a natural preserve there to preserve an area for tigers that we spent 2 days in. Hmm. And as we were going there, the guide said, look, I've been doing this 27 years now, and I've only seen tigers about 4 or 5 times. So don't get your hopes up. So we got there the first day, went out in the afternoon, and saw a mother and her cub, and got several pictures of her. Then the next day we went back again and we followed, I think it was 4 tigers all together for over an hour. They were going around the lake and doing various things. And we just kind of stayed on the road going and walking, and it was incredible seeing them in their habitat. Plus, we saw several other animals. We saw something called a sloth bear. From a significant distance, we saw one leopard. But, I mean, he was up on the side of a mountain. We could barely see him, but we did see a leopard.
Nice.
Yeah. So it was the Taj Mahal, of course, we went to. And we went over to the Ganges and spent a day watching people bathing their sins off. Perhaps one of the highlights was one evening we went to spend the meal and a couple, 3 hours with an Indian family. It was a married couple who had one daughter and then have adopted seven other daughters. So they have eight daughters. Wow. In the house. And the girls all were very poised. They all speak English. And one of them sat with each of our tables. We had about six or seven tables and talked with us. And we really had an interesting evening. So that was, then the other real highlight was one night we went to a sitar concert.
Okay.
And listened to a guy who's one of the more prominent sitar artists in the world. He tours around the world. And, sitar music is, if you just listen to it for a minute or two, it doesn't sound like very much. But if you sit there and you watch the performer and realize that it's almost all improvising, they have a very short melody, and then the rest of the concert is improvising off that melody. And like any jazz musician who's improvising, they're laughing as they play because, wow, that really went well. And he was looking over at the percussionist, and they would laugh at each other, make faces. God, and the music was just mind-boggling, I thought. Not everybody liked it that much, but I could have sat for hours.
Very good. You mentioned India and one other place.
Nepal. We went hoping to be able to see Everest because it's not that we were in Kathmandu, but the smog and dirt in the air was so, we couldn't even see the foothills until the very last day.
Wow.
When we were just able to make out the foothills a little bit. But we toured a couple villages and went several places. So it was quite interesting. It was at the end of the Nepal trip is when I came down with my influenza.
So you didn't actually climb Everest this time?
No.
Maybe next time?
I didn't do any mountain. my Kilimanjaro was my last mountain climbing. That was 5 years ago. The friend who talked me into that trip wanted to go again this year. In fact, he went. He wanted me to go. And I said, Biju, I don't think I'm up to it this year. And indeed, that's right. There's no way I would have made it. I'm 83 now. So, that day has passed me. It was a wonderful trip. Anyone who's in fairly good shape can make it. But when you're in your 80s, whether or not you're in good shape for 80, you're still 80.
Right. Yeah. So did I sort of hijacked you to ask about the trip? Did you have another non-newsy thing you wanted to talk about that you had in mind before I do my movie?
Nope. That's what I was going to bring up.
Okay. See, I just have this mental ability, and I was able to read your mind and guess what you were going to talk about. So
there you go. Well, it was the last 4 weeks. I mean, we got back Monday, and other than that, it was 4 weeks over there. So not much else has happened to me. We did. My iPad broke down about 3 days into the trip, so I really didn't even get to read news very much. It's hard to read news and interact with it with an iPhone, which is all I had.
Okay, so movie for me. We are up to a movie. I have such a big backlog at this point because, I caught up on the show giving the movies that I'd watched before, and then I went a long, long time before I actually updated my master list with all the movies I'd seen and all this kind of stuff. So we've got a few dozen of these. But the problem is, I think I'm actually watching these things at a rate that's maybe even slightly higher than once a week. So I'll never catch up if I only do one review a week. I might need to do two at some point. But I'm going to stick with one a week for now, and then we'll see how it goes. But anyway, the next up is something I watched in June 7th, 2024. Ralph Breaks the Internet from 2018. Have you heard of this thing?
I don't think I've heard of that one.
Okay, so this is a Disney movie. It is a sequel. It is a sequel to Wreck-It Ralph. Have you heard of Wreck-It Ralph?
No.
So let me talk about both of them in a minute. I did watch Wreck-It Ralph earlier. I'll check to see when I watched Wreck-It Ralph. Hold on a second. But I'm bringing up the wrong website. You know, it is silly of me. Okay, I watched Wreck-It Ralph back, which is a 2012 movie, back in 2022, and then Ralph Breaks the Internet in June 2024, which was from 2018. So basically, the theme of this series is that it's basically about video game characters. So the first movie is in an arcade, and you have the characters of a couple of video games. One of them is Wreck-It Ralph, who's sort of a character. He's the bad guy in a video game that tries to wreck a building, and the hero plumber, you know, clearly inspired by Mario, tries to keep him from breaking the building. But like, the conceit of it is that the video game is their jobs, and then the game ends and they go back to their lives. So it's like people clocking out of a job. So like Wreck-It Ralph, whose job in the video game is to be the mean villain trying to break down the building or whatever, is really a really nice guy. And he's good friends with the plumber who's trying to stop him. You know, sort of the bell goes off and they like shake hands, good day work, blah, 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 blah. And then go off and go to the bar together and all that kind of stuff. And then the other girl who's in here is Vanellope, who's a character in a racing video game called Sugar Rush, which is all sort of like, you know, candy and popsicles and little cars running around. It's sort of like a version of Mario Kart, but with sort of the candy girlish theme, etc. And the first movie deals with the candy Sugar Rush game is malfunctioning, and they have to like, they have to do something. Wait, I'm confusing the two movies. I have to make sure I have this right. In the first game, the Vanellope is a glitchable character, and there's adventures within the thing. And anyway, look, the first movie I gave a thumbs up to. It's a lot of fun. These are both animated Disney movies. They are cute. They are fun. They are the kind of things that are intended for kids, but also aimed so in adults will enjoy them as well. There's lots of nostalgia bait for older millennials, Gen X, etc., who, you know, went to like physical arcades where you put quarters in the video game machines when they were kids. And so there's, you know, this cameos by all kinds of video game characters that you would remember from when you were a kid in the arcades. And the first one's very cute. There's sort of emotional heartstrings at the end where, you know, they save Vanellope. Spoilers, like happy ending. Sorry, I maybe shouldn't have given away that there's a happy ending.
I'm not sure how many of us will be watching it.
But, you know, they the first one has a bunch of nice heartstrings. It works well. You end up, you know, with a little tear in your eye. The second one, they sort of escape the arcade and have to go to the internet. So what I was saying before about like the machines malfunctioning and they need a part, that's the second one. They basically go to the internet to try to find the broken part for the arcade game. The first one was a lot of drama within the game itself and trying to go beyond what the programming was and things like that. The second one, they escape to the internet basically and are in the wider world of the internet, you know, trying to find this part and get everything saved. The Vanellope character is tempted by getting into sort of grittier, more grown-up games that she finds once she's on the internet. And, you know, and you know, again, happy ending. Everything's good at the end, but the characters, do get to grow and move on and not just do what they were doing before. And if I had to say, the first one's probably a little bit better than the second one, but they were both good. I'm going to give a thumbs up to both of them. Enjoyable, fun, animated movies. You know, I honestly found myself thinking, hey, it would be nice if there was a third one. There is not a third one yet. I don't even see that they're planning a third one. But the critical response for the second one, looking at the second one now, Rotten Tomatoes gives it an 88%. They actually say it levels up on its predecessor with a funny, heartwarming sequel that expands on its colorful universe while focusing on core characters and relationships. And yeah, so audiences polled give it an A- on an A to F scale, down from an A on the first film. So that sort of coincides with me saying it's down a little bit from the first movie, but still both very good. And yeah, so Ralph Breaks the Internet. Do watch both of them if you're going to see these movies. If you have a kid to watch them with, even better. It'll be fun. But really, look, it's nostalgia hacking for people, you know, I'd say 40 and above, you know, especially, like I said, especially those who are in the prime age of like actually playing video games at physical arcades with quarters, but also going a little bit past that to like home consoles and stuff like that, the first couple generations of home consoles. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. I recommend them. Thumbs up. I enjoyed it. You know, watch these movies. It's cool.
I'll have to get after my grandchildren. They have some great grandchildren. My youngest grandchild gets her doctor's degree in occupational therapy in a month or two. So if they'll just get busy and provide me some great grandkids, I'll have someone I can take.
Well, there you go. Speaking of which, I'll just throw this out here. My younger sister, who's a veterinarian in Toronto, is like 8.5 months pregnant right now. So any moment now, I could be an uncle for the first time. And very, very, very excited about that. Haven't worked out when we'll go visit the new youngster yet. I'm assuming the new parents will need some time. And I'm also sort of crushed with some work stuff right now. So I don't know when I'll get up there, but I'll get up there before the kid is like too old to meet them and all that kind of stuff. You know, so yeah. So I'm thinking of my sister Cynthia. So hopefully all that goes as smoothly as you would want it to go and all of that. And yeah, you know, I'll mention again, since I just did, like, yeah, I'm swamped with job stuff now, but very much interested in trying something new. Ablesme.com, ablsme.com/resume. If anybody out there has any tips or intros or anybody they'd want to put me in touch with, you can see what's on that resume, but interested in, sure, things that align with my resume. Obviously, that's the most natural path, but also wouldn't mind looking at things that were a change. So I am so like wanting something different. But anyway, yes, which includes, by the way, if you guys want to like put enough into the Patreon to replace my salary so I can just do Curmudgeon's Corner full time, I'd be completely up for that as well. You know, so if you have the resources to add a few more zeros to your Patreon contribution, please like go right. I'm not going to stop you, you know. So anyway, that is it, I think, for our intro. So we'll take our first break. And then when we get back, we'll let Ed pick the first of his more serious current events, what's going on in the world right now kind of topics, and we'll go from there. So here comes a break. No, it's not the beginning of the show again. We're just taking a little time to credit the artist responsible for the music we use at the beginning and end of the show. What you are listening to right now is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. The music we close our show with is Celestial Soda Pop. Both of these songs are from Deep Breakfast. Now platinum, Deep Breakfast was the first independently released album ever to be certified gold by the RIAA. Ray Lynch's other albums are The Sky of Mind, No Blue Thing, Nothing Above My Shoulders But the Evening, and The Best of Ray Lynch. You can check out Ray Lynch or buy his music at raylynch.com, iTunes, Amazon, or anywhere you usually find music. Okay, we're back here. So, Ed, what are you thinking?
Well, I was thinking we might, since I'm a retired physician, there's been a lot of medical stuff lately, and I thought we might just kind of touch on a few of them. Excellent. Relatively short at a time. The first one that just kind of, the final steps on it came out yesterday, I think, was Gene Hackman's death.
Ah, yes.
And it turns out, after some confusion at the beginning, that what happened is he was apparently suffering from fairly advanced Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And his wife, who was his caretaker, quite a bit younger than him, I think she was in her mid-60s,
yeah,
and he was right. 95. But she apparently incurred an infection called hantavirus, which is usually seen in New Mexico and Arizona, where they lived, and the desert mice droppings carry hantavirus. So it occurs in people who have been cleaning that up. That apparently happened to her, and I'm going to guess that maybe she wasn't doing so well herself, because if as far gone as he was in the Alzheimer's, it's a 24-hour-a-day job, and people who are the only caretaker really get run down. But right. In any event, she died in their laundry room, I think, and he died several days later.
Let me ask a little bit more, not knowing pretty much anything about hantavirus. Is this something that would have, could it have been treatable? Like, is this something where she would have noticed and gone to a doctor and it would have been fine? Or is this something that comes on quickly and then it just overcame her?
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about it, but I think it doesn't come on just bang and you drop dead. There's some time, but as I said, if she was exhausted from taking care of him, her own immune resistance would have been diminished, and she probably didn't seek help when she got sick. She figured it was a cold, upper respiratory illness, which is how it presents, and I think it just got ahead of her and she died.
Mm. This is one of those things where, you sort of, like you said, it's sort of like, oh, it's just a cold. It's just a flu. I don't even have to worry about this. I'll just like push my way through it. And then it gets worse, I guess, rapidly at some point. And she fell or
probably
passed out,
yeah,
or something. And that was it.
Yeah. And it's, as I said, even treated, it's got a fairly high mortality rate. So it's not a minor illness at all. It's just it's kind of one of those relatively rare things that a lot of people don't ever encounter and don't think of it.
The sad
part of this is that he then lived several days and apparently is far enough gone with his Alzheimer's that he didn't realize that she was dead. And he basically starved to death or got weaker and weaker and had a heart attack and died. So it's kind of all around. If there's any take home advice.
Just to complete the story, they also had several dogs.
Yep.
One of the dogs was in a crate. The dogs that were not in a crate fended for themselves and lived. The one that was in the crate with no food and no water expired after a few days because no water. And
I think the biggest takeaway I can think on this is if you're taking care of a relative or somebody with dementia, progressive dementia, you need to have some time off now and then. You absolutely have to find a place where you can have downtime. When my father was fairly far gone in dementia, they had a bus that would come around, pick people up, and take them to a park downtown, and they could be entertained for several hours. And my mother spent those 4 or 5 hours sleeping in bed because she knew he was safe, and she didn't have any. And that saved her life, because when he finally died of his dementia, she, was still going strong.
Right.
But it's just to think you can take care of somebody alone with dementia is a bad mistake. People need to get help. They need to get some time off, at least a day or so a week in which you're on your own and somebody else comes in, family member, nurse, whatever.
Right.
But they obviously had no help because they were dead for over a week before the bodies were found. If they had had a visiting nurse, there would have been a different outcome there.
Right. Yeah. No, it's sad all around on that one.
Oh, yeah.
Just the sequence of events that played out. And like you said, there are a variety of opportunities where even if you just had somebody else checking in occasionally to say hi,
yep,
things could have turned out a little bit differently, at various stages. Could have saved the dog, could have saved Hackman a little longer, maybe even could have saved her, depending. So, yeah. So, okay, what other medical thing did you have in mind?
The next thing on my list is we have the measles epidemic going on in the States.
Yep.
And there's a couple observations on that. Number one, measles is probably one of the top two or three most infectious diseases that we deal with. There's a mathematical formula called R-naught, which is abbreviated with a capital R and a zero, that measures how infectious diseases are. And it's a scale of 0 to 16 or 17, something like that. Measles comes in at 15, meaning that as a minimum, it means that if one person is with a bunch of people who haven't been immunized, at least 15 of them will become infected with measles. To compare that, for instance, COVID, which we thought of as being a highly contagious disease, has an R-naught of 2 to 3.
Right.
Polio has an R-naught of 2. Several other illnesses. I think even smallpox, they have to estimate, but its R value is somewhere in 3 to 5, which much lower. So
15 is huge.
Absolutely. And the only way to treat it is to not get it through vaccine. If 95 or more percent of the population are vaccinated, that other 5% will be likely to get measles because the virus is out there all the time. But it won't spread as an epidemic like what's happening in Texas and New Mexico right now. And the chances of people dying from it would be very little. As a rule, about one out of every 1,200 kids who gets infected dies. And we've had one already.
I think the latest update is one kid and one adult have now died.
Yeah, an adult. Neither of whom I think were vaccinated. I don't know if it's...
No, that's correct. Sure on the no adult. Vaccinations.
Yeah. Now, the other thing is that there are some over-the-counter remedies pushed by the anti-vaxxers and other people. One of those is vitamin A.
Yeah.
And there is a little science behind that, because in countries where malnutrition and health is very poor, vitamin A supplements can help kids who get measles and maybe even lower the incidence slightly. But in a country such as ours, where vitamin A deficiency is rare, almost non-existent, giving extra vitamin A is not without hazard, because vitamin A is one of the fat-soluble vitamins, which means that it's taken up in fat in the liver specifically and stored, and your body doesn't get rid of an overdosage very rapidly. So one of the side effects of an overdosage of vitamin A is liver failure and death, which strikes me as not a great idea.
Yeah.
And especially
because, like you said, Americans typically have enough A anyway. So even taking the supplement might already be more than you need. But also, there seems to be a tendency, and I'm not going to say this is universal, but among the kind of people who would respond and say, hey, I can avoid measles just by taking vitamin A, to also just think, hey, well, if a little bit is good, a lot must be better.
That is, we saw that during COVID with the stuff they were taking for, they're supposed to take care of parasites.
The Invermycin or whatever it was?
Ivermectin, yeah.
Yeah, Ivermectin.
Yeah, a little bit's good. Taking an IV is even better. And, and then, of course, the other side of that, cod liver oil has a lot of vitamin A in it. So there are those out there. I'm not going to mention names, but there is one fairly prominent citizen.
It's RFK Jr.
Yeah. He is sending vitamin K to the, saying this will help. It doesn't help. There's absolutely no studies showing that cod liver oil is a benefit. Maybe because it has the A in it, it would have a slight benefit. Not enough to prevent death, not enough to prevent infection. It's quackery, basically. And it's kind of sad. But what they need to do, and I don't see it's happening, is they need to be getting down there and having an emergency vaccination of everybody who hasn't had the vaccines.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is one of those clear breaks that having someone like RFK Jr. in charge of HNHS, which in turn has all of these health agencies under it, is clear immediately. Like, yeah. If you had a flat out, like, straight up science-based response to this, it would be exactly what you said. It would be like, holy crap. We thought we had eliminated this disease in this country a while ago.
Actually, around 2000, they said it's not there anymore.
Yeah, and vaccination rates have dropped. We are now having an outbreak in a part of the country that has low vaccination rates. We are immediately going to go in there with a really strong campaign about how you need to protect yourself, you need to protect your family. Get the vaccine. Here it is. It's free. There are clinics set up all over the place. You can get it at your local drugstore, whatever. And just, have a massive campaign trying to get that to happen. Now, we know from what happened with COVID that those kinds of things can get politicized and people can be like, no, it's the government trying to control me and blah, 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 blah. But, the one advantage of having somebody like Trump or even RFK Jr., if he'd actually like suck it up and just follow the science here, is that you can perhaps get some of those skeptical people to trust you if you're coming from that point of view. If you're someone who they trust anyway, and you don't let it become a wedge issue. I mean, even during COVID, there's no reason that had to be a wedge issue. That could have been a consistent bipartisan. I mean, hell, the vaccine came, Donald Trump was a big pusher of getting the vaccine developed early. And he was an early, proponent of it until, it was clear, various other people in his party were like, we don't like this vaccine thing. But yeah, no, that would be the approach. Instead, we've got RFK Jr. talking about cod liver oil, vitamin A, and various holistic things. And it's just the result is going to be greater spread than we'd see otherwise and more dead people. I mean, it's not.
Well, the other thing we always forget in measles is that one out of every 1,200 kids dies. Two or three out of every 1,200 kids has permanent brain visual and hearing damage because it gets into the brain and does nasty things to them. There's a heartbreaking story early on in this thing of a man who works in public health now, whose daughter came down with meningitis, with measles years ago before the vaccines were there. And she was doing great. And he was reading her stories at night and entertaining her. And then one night she seemed a little drowsy and not responding too well. She was dead 18 hours later.
Oh, this is Roald Dahl, right?
I don't remember who it was. It was an editorial. I didn't pay attention to who it was him. Yeah.
Let me make, this is a famous editorial and I believe it is Roald Dahl, but let me get the difference.
But I think that was before vaccine. So this was 60 years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That would be right. His age. Yeah.
Roald Dahl. Okay. My spelling is I'm horrible. I'm trying to Google this and I can't spell the guy's name. I can't spell measles. I can't. Yeah, anyway. Yes.
D-A-H-L.
it is indeed Roald Dahl, R-O-A-L-D-D-A-H-L. He's famously, he wrote Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. He wrote Matilda. The letter comes from 1988, which is which is right before he died. And it's basically, like you said, it's begging. I'll read a little bit of a quote from it that it ties along with what you said. The full letter is longer. You can find it on, if you just Google Roald Dahl measles, you'll find it right away. But the quote here, Olivia, my eldest daughter, caught measles when she was 7 years old. As the illness took its usual course, I can remember reading to her often in bed and not feeling particularly alarmed about it. Then one morning, when she was well on the road to recovery, I was sitting on her bed, showing her how to fashion little animals out of colored pipe cleaners. And when it came to her turn to make one herself, I noticed that her fingers and her mind were not working together, and she couldn't do anything. "Are you feeling all right?" I asked her. "I feel all sleepy," she said. In an hour, she was unconscious. In 12 hours, she was dead. So she died in 1962, like you said, before the measles vaccine.
Yep. That's the year I started med school.
And he dedicated a couple of his later books to her, James and the Giant Peach and the BFG. And yeah, he was just a big... He spent a lot of his life after this advocating for vaccines, and he was of the opinion that refusal to vaccinate your kids was almost, quote unquote, almost a crime, and he was one that was pushing for mandatory vaccinations for a lot of things.
Yeah,
and what we see here is just like over the last couple decades, I mean, for something like measles specifically, like independent of some of the misinformation about the risks of vaccines, there's been also the sort of thing, well, measles is gone. Why do we need to vaccinate for it anymore? You know? And so a lot of people think that way of like, you know, well, this is useless. And the thing is, it's because it's not really gone. It's just very, very, very rare at this point, and people are protected from it. And the reason it's gone is because everyone was vaccinating. And like, and for a lot of diseases, I'm not sure if this is the case with measles, but even after you don't have human cases for a while, you can have reservoirs hiding out in the animal population, or you can have similar diseases that the vaccine would also protect against that could recur. There are all kinds of ways for things to come back. Now, if you really and truly get to the point where, you know, hey, it's been 150 years and there's nothing similar out there at all, okay, maybe you could consider that. But like, take the scientific recommendation on that, not just be like, oh, me as a layperson decides there's no risk anymore, and so therefore I'm not going to take it or have my kids take it. Let me ask you one more question about measles before we move on to other stuff. Given the, you know, like you were saying, that this has an R0 of 15 compared to like 2 or 3 for COVID. So why do we only have 2 deaths so far? Why isn't this like going crazy?
Well, we've had only 1,000 cases so far, or it's getting close. No, what is it? A couple hundred, I think, so far, isn't it?
I'm not remember. Sure. I know 2 deaths, but I'm not sure on number of cases.
The death rate usually is around 1 out of every 1,200. So we won't have that many deaths. And I don't know if we haven't had any of the brain infections yet or what, but it's a relatively small population there, apparently, of one of the, I think, a Mennonite sect that had decided they didn't need to vaccinate. The majority of the infections have been in those people.
But, well, the thing is, though, and maybe a majority of the cases are here too, but the overall vaccination rate has dropped somewhat just because of the vaccine skepticism stuff, like the stuff RFK Jr. is doing in terms of trying to scare people about side effects that don't really exist or are incredibly rare, trying to connect things like this to autism, which, like, no, again, and even if it were, by the way, with, you know, an entire family on the spectrum, including myself, I believe, even though I've never been officially diagnosed, like, you shouldn't be afraid of that. Like, it's a death sentence anyway, but it's not related to the vaccines.
Yeah. this concept of it's all gone worked with smallpox because the only reservoir for smallpox was human beings. As far as we know, there aren't any animals. That this monkeypox is a similar infection, but a lot lower mortality rate. Smallpox had 30-40% mortality rate. But there is no smallpox in the world right now.
Well,
we don't need to vaccinate for it.
There's still a couple in vials in a lab somewhere, right?
There are. Yeah.
Somebody could take one of those vials out and intentionally reintroduce it at some point.
Which is why for a long time the military kept on vaccinating us. And then somewhere around 1980, they said, we're hurting more soldiers than we're helping.
Right.
And so they quit vaccinating us. And I think that was a wise idea. But we still have
on all this, you have to do the math. You have to approach it scientifically. You have to say, you have to look at the probabilities correctly in terms of and this is something that people have trouble with anything, right? There's a one in a gabillion chance of something really awful happening if I take this medicine, so I don't want to take it. Well, meanwhile, the chances of you getting some disease and having a bad outcome are 1 in 1,000 if you don't take the medicine. Yes, there's a chance that something goes wrong, but it's a much smaller chance than the chance of something going wrong if you don't take it. So you have to do the math. You have to figure this out. You have to pay careful attention to the studies. You also have to know what the hell you're talking about. Because if you look at some of the data sheets on possible side effects and stuff, even the stuff they list on the TV commercials and stuff, it's just hey, has anybody ever reported this alongside while they were taking the medicine? There's not necessarily all the time, sometimes there is, but there's not necessarily proof of a cause-effect relationship. Those warnings on the TV commercials don't give you numbers in terms of how likely particular outcomes are. There are also certain things that are more or less likely depending on your own current medical history. So if you've got XYZ, then this is counterindicated. If you don't, then it's not. The point is, it's complex. And there's all kinds of information, there's all kinds of uncertainty, and to make a rational decision, you have to actually have some expertise and know what the hell you're talking about. And the danger is when people come in and see one thing, have no idea what they're really looking at, and make an off-the-cuff decision that, is not an educated decision and is often a bad decision. Now, I'm not saying that, patients shouldn't have some right in their own treatment. Of course they should. But it's important, there's this whole death of expertise going on where everybody thinks that they can figure out everything they need and they don't have to pay attention to experts. And, I'm sorry. There is a reason you want to pay attention to people who spend their whole lives studying something over somebody who spends 5 minutes, if that, popping open a Wikipedia page, or even worse. Oh, well, Joe Rogan said so, or RFK Jr. said so.
Yep.
Sorry. I went off for a second.
Yeah, no problem. I think the reason, the justification for having mandatory vaccines for kids to go to school is to prevent epidemics in schools, obviously. But even beyond that is that there are all sorts of kids anymore who have been treated for leukemia and various other things who have compromised immune systems.
Yeah.
And if your kid takes measles into school, even though that child might have been vaccinated, their protection may not be very good and they may get it and die of it. Yeah. I had one patient die of chickenpox when I was in practice. It was a little girl. This was before we had the vaccine for chickenpox. And this little girl was treated for acute myelogenous leukemia, which I had diagnosed. And we were treating her. I was treating her in conjunction with the real oncologist. It was a 100-mile trip to the oncologist. So they would send the drugs back and I would give them to her. And she would see them once a month and me a couple of times a month. Anyway, her little brothers caught chickenpox at school. And 5 days later, she was dead.
Yeah.
And, I'll never forget sitting there with their mothers, friends of ours, as the child died. So, the vaccines prevent that. if there had been a vaccine then and the brothers had been vaccinated, that little girl would probably still be alive because she was just then going into remission.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that high note.
It is extremely frustrating when, you know, it's one thing, like when COVID was brand new, we didn't have treatments. We didn't have a vaccine. We were still trying to figure out what the hell was going on. There was a lot of people informed people, like, doing their best with very limited information. And some of the things that were suggested at the beginning turned out to not be relevant. For instance, in the end, it is absolutely clear COVID was airborne and not really droplet-based. Surfaces weren't really an issue. So, like, if you remember at the very beginning, everybody was talking about cleaning all the surfaces.
Yeah.
You know, and
we did that when he got back from the grocery store.
Yeah.
Wipe everything down.
Now, that's good for some other diseases. It's probably a good practice anyway. But, you know, and like a lot of the protections that were advocated at the beginning assumed droplet was the primary mode of transmission. It turns out, no, it wasn't droplet. It really was truly airborne, which is really, really fine particles as opposed to bigger droplets. And but at first we didn't know anything. And so there was a lot of we erred perhaps towards overprotection or protecting the wrong things in some cases. There was always sort of a reluctance to truly embrace the airborne thing. I mean, even now people aren't doing what they need to with ventilation. But the point is, though, now we do have treatments. Now we do have vaccines for COVID, for measles, for chickenpox and all the other things you're talking about, and a whole host of childhood diseases. And thankfully, most people still at this point follow the recommended guidelines for young children and get all the vaccinations they're supposed to. But the fact that there's a growing percentage who don't and are like, yes, science has found good ways to avoid this disease, but we don't want to. What? It's just incredibly frustrating.
Yep.
Especially when, like you said, the fact that the people who decide not to vaccinate are not just affecting themselves, because for all of these diseases, they can make it easier for it to transmit to other people. They can, once they get sick, they get other people sick. It's not a case where this decision only affects you when you have things, and measles is a primary example of this, where it really is like, if you get that vaccination rate, like really high, like over 95%, it makes a huge difference compared to if it's even 90.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
So, okay. One more health thing. Or did you have another? I have another if you don't.
I've got another quickie.
What is it?
Well,
it may be the same one. What's your last one?
Okay. Well, I was just going to comment that there's been some more uproar about fentanyl deaths.
Ah, okay.
And importing of fentanyl. And just, I think it was earlier today or last week, whatever, the fentanyl deaths in the United States began dropping in January of 2024. At this point, it's down about 60% of what it was at the peak. It's unclear just what has caused that. But one of the things is a drug called naloxone, which probably a lot of people should just simply have it. You don't know when you're going to be walking down the street and some guy will collapse of an overdosage, and you can save their life with a dose of naloxone.
Yeah, my wife is a big proponent of these kinds of things. I believe she carries around some, and we have some somewhere in the house. I should know where it is. But I don't carry it around, but this is definitely has made a big difference in terms of, you know, A, people carrying it around, but B, just having it available quickly in certain places as well. This is the nasal spray, right?
Yeah, that's the one. It can be injectable or nasal spray.
Right.
But a lot of people don't like give shots, so they have the nasal spray.
Right. And so this is basically, you know, hey, if somebody's having an overdose and you got this stuff, you can take it from being, you know, an acute situation to a better situation quickly. Like, I'm not sure if it completely solves everything. Like, you don't even have to follow up, but you probably do, right, Ed? Like it helps.
Some people will need two or three doses, so because it wears off fairly quickly. So yeah, no, you can't just give it and say, okay, you're cured and go away. it doesn't obviously change the addiction,
right?
But it keeps people alive so they can get treated for addiction, which is kind of neat. So yeah, I mean it's very few. The dangers from it are pretty minimal. So, I mean, there are people out there who say, if you come across anybody for any obvious reason, you should give them naloxone. It's not going to hurt them. Might save their life.
Right.
But anyway, it's kind of nice to see that we're winning that game even without tariffs.
Yeah. Well, the stupid tariffs. Yes. The cross-border stuff of this, especially on the Canada side, but even on the Mexico side, from what I hear, is not like the big problem. Like,
no. Actually, I understand that the majority of the fentanyl coming in is carried by U.S. citizens with their passports coming through and not getting. And in all honesty, when we came back from India and I went through what used to be a fairly intensive, you know, inspection by the border patrol or whatever, we walked up, I showed them my passport, and they said goodbye.
Right.
I was through that line in the because I'm an old fart, they grabbed me and put me at the front of the line. I went into the room and was on my way to the baggage in less than 2 minutes.
Nice. Okay. The other health thing that since we have this segment on health stuff, what's the latest with bird flu, Ed?
Oh, God. It's still primarily a bird flu, and it's still hitting our chickens. Apparently, there is a vaccine for it, for chickens.
Hmm.
Our farmers apparently are resisting, Farmers Association, resisting using that vaccine because they say that would hurt exports.
Yeah, well,
we've wiped out half of our crops now, so there's no exporting of eggs right now. We're importing them.
Apparently, there are a bunch of countries that will not let you import birds that have been vaccinated. Now,
well, do they want the eggs though? I think it's because they won't even take the eggs.
Yeah, they probably won't take anything. You know, you could probably have a whole debate on that and like whether that's an appropriate restriction or not.
Yeah.
We've
got a shortage of eggs. Who wants to export them? We'll buy any they can make. But anyway, at this point, what they do is if your flock gets the bird flu, you kill your whole flock.
Well, and that's
killing farmers.
That's one of the things the Trump administration is saying they're actively looking at how to change. The protocol was exactly what you said for years and years and years. This wasn't just a Joe Biden thing, but for years and years, the protocol was if you get any infection whatsoever, you kill them all to avoid spread. And so what they're looking into now is whether you can look at physical isolation stuff as well. Now, the notion was once you have one of your like commercial flock infected, the way, you know, and this gets to how inhumane American animal processes go anyway, they're often extremely overcrowded in spaces that aren't well ventilated, you know, and so basically it's a reasonable assumption that if you got one sick bird, they're probably all infected. But the notion of the physical barriers and such, A, is that most of these flocks, the initial infection comes from the wild, where they have, you know, a duck or a goose or something that's wild, lands in with the chickens, infects the chickens, and then takes off again. So if you introduce physical barriers that basically make it so, hey, the wild animals have no ability to contact the domestic flocks at all.
I think they still poop though.
Well, you have to have roofs. You have to have physical barrier all the way around, right? You know, it's not just a wall. And that's part of what they're thinking about this, but this is also very expensive. And also, even within the flocks, you know, I mentioned, you know, big, overcrowded, blah, blah, blah. You could also introduce more robust physical barriers between parts of your flock. So it's not just like, you know, a million birds in one big space or whatever. You, you separate them out and isolate them from each other. So if you do get an infection, you don't have to kill all of them. You kill a smaller group of them. And then, you know, and of course, like you mentioned, there's the vaccine. One thing, you know, people don't seriously consider treatment because it doesn't scale as well, right? You know, it's like if you've got a flock of hundreds of thousands of birds, you know, that only live a few weeks anyway, typically before you slaughter them, or longer for egg birds, but for meat birds, you know, you're not going to go individually treating each chicken as if it was your family dog with, you know, individual vet attention. And I don't know, maybe we should, but that just isn't like what that industry would consider. One thing that was brought up in terms of the egg shortage as well is one of the reasons is it's like we're talking about egg shortages, but we're not talking about chicken meat shortage, is just how quick the turnaround is on meat birds. Like literally they slaughter these birds after like a month to a month and a half.
Really?
Wow. And often. And so basically they're like, look, you know, we lose an entire flock of meat birds. We can replenish that supply in six to eight weeks and be back where we were. But for laying hens, we need to wait until they're sexually mature and laying eggs. And that takes more like 6 months. And so, you know, if we slaughter a bunch of egg laying hens, then it's a lot longer before production capacity is back to where it was.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so
I don't see it ending very soon.
Now, are we still, there have been a handful of human cases apparently in people who had contact with birds. Yeah. There have been a handful, I believe some cats have died as well. I believe in cases, again, the cat was in contact with wild birds, that kind of thing.
I don't think there's any documented human to human cases yet.
Right.
Animal to human.
Is that still a worry, or do we feel sort of at this point, we know what this is and it's, you know, it causes a problem to our egg supply, but it's not really a human concern directly.
I'm not enough of a virologist to answer, but I have heard at least one person who was supposedly an expert say that it would take only one mutation for it to become infectious to human. So yeah, it's probably a question of when does the time bomb go off? If she was right, and I had no reason to question her, she knows a lot more about it than I do.
Well, and to keep in mind, it may only need one mutation, but it needs the right mutation, right?
Like,
mutations are happening all the time in viruses, but like most of them won't have this effect. But if you get unlucky the one time,
apparently know which gene it is that would be affected. So that's
and also you have to add, not only does this mutation have to happen, it has to happen in a bird that ends up infecting a human, So, or I guess
if it infects other birds, they'll get to the humans.
You know? Yeah. Or I suppose you could have one of the small handful of infected humans could have the mutation there. There are a number of mechanisms, but it hasn't happened yet. So cross your fingers.
Well, remember that COVID probably came from bats.
Yeah.
And it didn't infect any humans until somewhere around 2019.
Right.
And then it took off after that.
Okay. Well, let's take a break.
Okay.
And when we get back, Ed, have your next topic prepared.
Okay.
Back after this.
What?
No, that was bad. Oh. No, that was bad. No.
Once upon a rainbow, you were on the floor, eating the bugs that you found upon my face.
No, what? Bye. Okay, we are back.
I timed that perfectly. I went out and got a glass of water.
Okay. So, Ed, next topic.
Have we talked at all about the private prison?
No.
Solutions to our crime problems?
We have not talked about private prisons. I'm not sure if we've ever talked about it, to be honest. Certainly okay. Not recently.
Okay. Well, just briefly, from something I read today, I think it was in the Times, New York Times, the private prisons, as we all know, have become a much popular issue in the United States. Rather than building new prisons, we hire it out to the private sector on contract. Mr. Biden apparently started to cut back on that, but he never finished off, really. I mean, he said, well, we want to get rid of all these private prisons, and he decreased the number of people in them, but never got rid of it.
And just to be clear, this is something that's happening at all levels, right? Like, yes, you know, federal, state, local.
Yeah. And where it came up as an issue to me this time is that apparently, because the private prisons have a fair number of empty beds right now, our government has decided, well, there's where we can put these immigrants. And so they are letting out new contracts. Several new contracts have been given, and they're about to build some new prisons. And it's a growth industry again. The stock market, apparently, if you look for those contractors, they're making big money and going to town. I don't know if there's an answer to that, but I do know that's a hell of a way to run a ship.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many problems with this. One is you create a natural incentive for a whole industry who's based on they do better the more prisoners there are. So like the notion of, hey, let's figure out the right way to deal with crime in a way that, you know, rehabilitates people, avoids future crime, et cetera, you know, just easily turns into, let's just jail as many people as possible, because that's how we make money. And most of these are set up as well that they're not, there may be some exceptions, but for the most part, they're not incentivized on quote unquote good outcomes, you know, where you do get the rehabilitation and the person coming out better for it and not being, you know, not being recidivist, et cetera. So it really does become warehousing as well. And conditions aren't always great. And, you know, and I know some people come in straight with the mindset, well, they're prisoners. The conditions shouldn't be great. But at the same time, there's, you know, there's a basic level of humanity that should exist, like even for our worst prisoners. And I mean, occasionally you see like, memes of like, you know, is this a Scandinavian prison or like a British dorm room, college dorm room? And like the British college dorm rooms are worse than the Scandinavian prisons in terms of amenities for the prisoner and how they look and blah, blah, blah. And I think, you know, fundamentally, a lot of this comes down to like, what is our philosophy of dealing with crime in the first place? And, you know, is it simply punishment? And I think for the most part in the U.S., it's punishment and revenge sort of lead the day in terms of what we're trying to do, rather than sort of an outcome-based, do we make the world better in the end after this sort of view of things? And I think that's a problem. But like, back to private prisons specifically, I think the everything I just mentioned applies to public prisons too, because they're a reflection of like our societal attitudes. But I think the problems are amped up to 11 on private prisons, because then you also add the profit motive and just like people trying to maximize the dollars no matter what. And I think it's exactly the wrong incentive to have in this sort of situation. There are a whole bunch of places where I think the profit motive helps in a lot of areas. I mean, there's a reason why capitalism has been successful and has driven all kinds of innovation. But there's certain areas where the profit motive provides really bad incentives that produce bad outcomes, we don't have to talk about all the others. I think there are plenty of others, but I think this is definitely one of them.
Yeah. Oh, no question. I add to that that many, maybe not most, but many public prisons have a fairly stringent policy on how guards are hired, monitored, and checked out before they get the job. The private prisons do not do a very good job of that, which means that
this is one of the rate things, of... This is or one of those things that, at the very least, if you're going to have a private prison, you would expect that the scenario would be that they'd have to meet or exceed the standards of the public prisons. But no! Yeah.
No. Because prisoner abuse has apparently become a real issue in a lot of these private prisons, because who is attracted to being a cop? All too frequently, bad guys are attracted to that because I get to beat people up and carry a gun.
And now, probably even more so for prison guards.
Well, yeah, absolutely. A good system screens those people out, and when they identify them, they kick them out. But I don't know that the private prisons are doing that. They don't give a damn. You know, they get paid $500 a prisoner a week or a month or whatever, and it's just the wrong way to do things. Plus, an awful lot of these people who are being picked up and kicked out of the country have not really committed crimes.
Yeah,
they committed the crime of coming here illegally. Okay, that's a crime. They have not robbed
people. Which, by the way, although there are people looking to adjust this, is at worst a misdemeanor, and in many cases is actually just a civil issue entirely.
Yeah.
It's not even criminal.
Yeah, but very few of these people have committed violent crimes, robberies, and other horseshit like that. I mean, they have come here to try and make a living, and they're willing to take jobs that don't pay very much and are hard jobs. But what we do is we arrest them and throw them in prison because we have a quota that you got to arrest 700 people a day, and they're not achieving it, so they're all sorts of crap coming because they can't arrest enough people.
Yeah. And look, everything they're doing with that, you know, and is we're, you know, first of all, like, they're not achieving the numbers of the deportations that Donald Trump wanted. And he's apparently getting madder and madder about that as the weeks go on. Like, why aren't you getting rid of these people? You're supposed to get rid of these people. And their deportation numbers are actually less than they were under Biden.
Biden got rid of a bunch.
Now, they have pointed out that intercepted border crossings are way down. So the thought is Donald Trump just being so hostile that he's actually discouraging people from trying? Maybe. Apparently what happened last time Donald was here was that there was a drop like this at the very beginning of his administration, while people sort of sussed out the situation and understood what was going on, and then it popped right back up again afterwards. So we'll see if we're in that kind of a situation. Because you could see them declaring victory. Some of them are already starting to. Like, oh, look, the crossings are down so much.
Yep.
That means this is all a success. We're doing great. Now, you know, I would argue that even so, like, gaining the success by being inhumane and brutal is not the right way to do it. But yeah, we're certainly not achieving all of Trump's goals on this. But if we are doing things by shipping people to inhumane situations in all kinds of different ways, whether it be the private prisons or hell, Guantanamo, we were doing for a little while. Apparently, we're backing off from that because it turns out that was hard and had all kinds of issues and was expensive. We're shipping people to foreign prisons. Like, I think El Salvador and Panama maybe both agreed.
El Salvador, which...
It was El Salvador.
Their prisons are not a place you want to be.
So they've apparently agreed to, like, accept a whole bunch of people that we're expelling and then figure out what to do with them separately. But, you know, if we ship somebody to somewhere that treats them inhumanely, it's still on us. You know, I think the take that the administration has to be is, like, we're just getting out of the country. What happens after that is none of our business. We don't care.
Yeah.
But it is our business. And frankly, if someone's here looking for asylum and we ship them back to someplace that the reason they were looking for asylum was they were in danger in that place, and we ship them back and something happens to them. Yeah, that's on us. And of course, there's a whole portion of the population that just doesn't care, but we should care. You know, I don't know. We're sort of pivoting from private prisons to the immigration issue, but like, yeah.
Well, it's the reason's because the private prisons are now getting all these immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can't put them in the regular prisons, I don't think. So they're contracting with those private prisons to take on the immigrants and hold them.
Yeah, and like you said, they're building new facilities. They're doing all kinds of things.
Yep.
There's some public facilities being built too, apparently, but and some things just being repurposed. But all in all, it's not great, and. And Donald Trump, if anything, is getting increasingly mad that they're not being inhumane enough.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. How many times did he say in the previous administration, when you're arresting these guys, don't protect their heads, just show them in the car? I don't want to talk about him.
Right.
The guy makes me sick to my stomach. So it's hard to talk about anything without him, you know, these days.
Any more on the private prisons or anything else before we start wrapping things
up?
Well,
the only other thing along in the medical stuff that I thought is kind of a good news story is the incidence of cancer of the cervix has been dropping a lot.
Hey, would this have anything to do with a vaccine?
It would indeed, because it began dropping when the vaccine was introduced. That's the good news.
HPV vaccine.
Yeah, the HPV. Actually, there's two strains, HPV 16, which is the really bad one, and I forget the number of the other one, but there's two strains that are covered. And the good news is that those people who get that are not getting cancer of the cervix, and presumably probably not going to get cancer of the mouth and throat, although only about 50-60% of cancer of the mouth and throat are from HPV. But that's half of the cases of cancer of the mouth and throat, which is a devastating cancer.
And just to be clear as well, like originally they were pushing this like for girls and women because they have cervix.
It's for everybody now.
But it's for everybody now because males can pass it along. And so the recommendation is that you kids should get the HPV vaccine. Is what right around puberty, right? Like, is
14 to 15 they're recommending before they become sexually active.
Before they become sexually active, which frankly can be before that. So, yeah. Get basically as soon as you're eligible, you should get that. Now, there was a lot of pushback on that initially from people being like, well, my kid's not sexually active. They're not going to be sexually active anytime soon because
there were the others who said, if you give it, then the kid will think that they can go out and be sexually active.
Yes. And of course you got the usual people who are like concerned about side effects that aren't really a concern as well. But like you had this whole thing with people saying that, this was being permissive. And of course my kid's going to be like a good chaste Christian. Wait till marriage. So there's no reason to have anything to do with this for years and years and years, if ever. And even then, they're only going to be with their wife or husband. So, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, come on, people. Come on. let's talk about the real world. Okay, fine. Your kid's not going to be doing that stuff. What harm is it? Like it's only going to help. You never know what situation is. Hell, your kid could get raped, mm-hmm. Like get the protection in place. And and it's proved highly effective at preventing a very serious cancer.
There used to be a little meme that said, you are not having sex with your sex partner. You're having sex with everybody that person's ever been with.
Right.
And that's kind of covered. The good news is that the incidence is dropping. I think in a few more years, we'll probably see that the oral pharyngeal cancer is also dropping.
The bad news on that is that the incidence of women getting pap smears and checks for cancer is going down. Now, it's, let's say, we used to do a pap smear every damn year, and we wouldn't give women their birth control until they came in and got it because we could make sure they got it done. You only need a pap smear about every 4 or 5 years now. It's just not an imposition. And I understand, I can't swear to this.
Well, just to be
there's a test, just
to be clear, any procedure like that is somewhat of an imposition, whether it's a pap smear or whatever. Like, but it's not that it's not an imposition. It's that there are significant benefits associated with it that you want to balance off against that.
Sure.
Preventative healthcare. You would much rather have good preventative healthcare than have to deal with the problem of a cancer or anything else after it's there.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I was going to say is that there is a test now that you can do yourself at home for the HPV 16 strain, which is the most serious one. So if your objection is having a doctor look at your private parts, you can take care of that yourself. But God damn it, do it. Don't just say, well, I don't need to do that because I've always been careful.
Right.
It just doesn't work. It's like I'll never get measles because I never get around with anyone who's sick with measles.
Well, and like I said, more generally, preventive care in general, get your colonoscopies, take whatever tests they say you need to take. If you do your vaccinations, et cetera, et cetera. If they're maintenance medications that your doctor recommends for chronic conditions, actually take them, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know?
Can I tell you one advantage of being over 80 now?
What's
I don't that? Have to get colonoscopies anymore.
They're like, if something happens, screw it. It's too late. Basically.
No, well, that's it. Because from the earliest detection, which is what you find with colonoscopy, the dying of it is 15 to 20 years. So, you know, if you're 80, you're going to die before you die. Anyway.
Oh, come on. You're going to make it to 120, 125, aren't you?
I doubt it. Not the way I feel this one. just to add to the fun, you know, last year I did a year-long walk-run exercise program that was to have 2,025 miles in the course of the year.
Wow.
And I made it. I made a little over 2,100 miles. So I was quite good. However, in October, I started to run and my knees started to hurt all of a sudden. And I have what's basically a stress fracture in the tibial plateau. And I think I'm through running forever. So I had to walk the rest of the year. And now, since the first of the year, I'm getting very few. I'm not even going to get 1,000 miles this year, I don't think.
Wow.
I'm really slowing down this year, getting too old.
Well, I hear that happens.
It does, yep.
You know,
I can still crack off. I mean, I can still crack. I did 4 miles yesterday with a workout in the gym in the middle, so I can still get 4 to 5 miles a day, which is enough.
You're getting more exercise than I get, and I know I'm bad for that, but more power to you, and I need to do better.
Anyway, I think that's pretty much, I mean, you got some other things, but I think that's probably enough for this year.
For this year. Yeah, there you go. Okay. Well, yeah, let's wrap it up then. Hey, everybody, as you know, go to curmudgeons-corner.com. You can find all our archive of shows. You can find transcript of recent shows. You can find all the ways to contact us. And if you want to get in contact with Ed, you can send it to us and we will relay appropriately. You can find, I still have not linked to TikTok. I am still posting highlights on TikTok every week. I am waiting at this point to see if TikTok continues to survive after the 90-day extension that they were given earlier. And okay, look, I'm just procrastinating. That's the real answer. I'm procrastinating. I don't want to do the extra work. But I will eventually add a link to TikTok as well. But you can search for Curmudgeon's Corner on TikTok and find us. The website has links to our YouTube, our Facebook, et cetera. We don't do much on Facebook. You know, it's just posts announcement of the episodes. There's a link to our Mastodon. We don't do much on Mastodon. It just posts links to the episodes and to the live streams when they come out. YouTube has our live streams live when they come out, or you can watch video of the whole unedited shows there. It's a lot. It's fun. The podcast experience with audio is different than the video experience. Take a dip at both. Like, yeah, typically I do more. The video takes more commitment is the bottom line. Like, audio podcasts, you put on in the car while you're driving, you put on your headphones while you're doing household chores, stuff like that does not require your full attention. If you're going to put something on video and actually watch it, then you have to actually sit there and watch it. Like, which, like, I admit, I am not a fan of video podcasts, but it's there if anybody wants. You can do that. Lots of people do like the video podcast. You can, of course, tune them out the same way as an audio podcast and do stuff anyway. The video is just on in the background. But anyway, all that stuff is there. Also, a link to our Patreon where you can give us cash money. As I mentioned earlier in the show, if you would like to give me enough money that I don't have to go to a corporate job, I would really appreciate that. That'd be fun. I would enjoy that. I would appreciate it. I would consider doing stuff for you in return. I don't know what, but, like, you know, I would accept that, you know, maybe I had to do something in exchange for that money other than just put out the show. But although, you know, the show is worth tons, obviously. Anyway, you can go to our Patreon at various levels of the Patreon. I will send you a postcard, send you a mug, mention you on the show. At this very moment, I owe Pete and Greg cards and I owe Ed a new mug. and I have not done those things. Like I said, I'm kind of swamped right now. I will get to them eventually, I promise. But at $2 a month or more, or if you just ask us, we will invite you to the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack, where Yvonne and others are chatting, sharing links throughout the week. And so let me find something. You know, I will pick the article and I will pick the most recently shared thing on the Slack, which was shared while we were recording. Yvonne, who was apparently too sick to join us to record the show, but not too sick to be posting on the Slack, posted an article from The Register. Developer sabotaged ex-employer with kill switch activated when he was let go. And so basically, let's see, a federal jury in Cleveland has found a senior software developer guilty of sabotaging his employer's systems, and he's now facing a potential 10 years behind bars. Davis Liu, 55, of Houston, Texas, was a seasoned coder employed by power management biz Eaton Corporation from 2007 to 2019. In his last year, there was a corporate restructuring and he was demoted, both in terms of job responsibilities and server access. So he began introducing home-designed malware onto at least one of the employer's production systems. He wrote a program that would, in an infinite loop, create more and more non-terminating threads that would consume more and more resources until the computer running the code crashed and prevented people from logging in and using the machine. And basically, the account had been used to execute the malware, and he was the only member of the team who had access privilege. He set it up with a dead man switch that basically would lock every employee out of their accounts if his credentials were revoked. So basically, it checked periodically to see if he was still with the company. And if he was no longer with the company, would start wrecking havoc.
Oh, dear.
So, yeah. So, folks, it may sound fun. It may sound like a nice way to get petty revenge on your ex-employer, but no. They will take it seriously for good reason. This guy's going to jail.
Good.
So don't do stuff like that.
This should be obvious.
Don't do stuff like this.
That's in the same category as these people who are firebombing Teslas. And one actually fired a rifle into a Tesla because a guy was driving a Tesla. Right? Those people need to have free room and board for years and years, not just a month or two.
Yeah, look, I'm not a fan of Elon either, but there've been incidents of setting fire to Tesla chargers. There've been many incidents of vandalism and property destruction to Tesla vehicles. There've been cases of harassing the drivers of these vehicles. The least obnoxious one I saw was pictures of somebody who's leaving essentially pamphlets on the windshields of people driving Teslas, basically saying, hey, we know when you bought this, it was cool. It was helping environmental causes. You thought it was great, but now it's not anymore. So you really should consider getting rid of this car. Here's some places, go list it on CarMax, go list it on whatever. It listed like three or four different sites that you can sell vehicles on. But they're like, look, it's changed. Everybody, you know, get out now before the only people left driving these things are MAGA Nazi wannabes, and people are justified in thinking badly for you for driving this car. Yeah. And that's still kind of obnoxious, but it's the least obnoxious I've seen. The people who are actually like spray painting graffiti on these things or breaking windows or setting fires. No, 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 no. It's not helpful. You know, that note is actually right. I mean, a lot of the people who bought Teslas several years ago are absolutely appalled by what Elon Musk has been doing more recently. You know, I saw something today about someone talking about how they desperately want to get rid of their Cybertruck, you know, but they can't get rid of it. Like they just can't find somebody to take it off their hands, even at a significant discount to what they paid. They are failing to have any way to get it off their hands. I mean, I guess absent abandoning it on the street somewhere. And somebody's eventually going to find them for if they do that, and because there are issues with that too, right?
Well, you know, you don't need to get violent and destructive to hurt them badly. I see that in Germany, the Tesla sales are down 70-some%, but at the same time, EV vehicles total sales are up 30%. So they're saying, screw it, we're not going to buy his stuff. You don't have to go out and destroy him. Just quit buying his stuff.
Yeah, well, and people are. I mean, it's not about the cars. It's not about like the company even that in what they're doing. It's about Elon and the fact that he's become toxic, and specifically, he has become toxic to what was the target audience for his company.
Yeah,
like the people who are buying Teslas. We're not MAGA conservatives who, you know, are buying big gas guzzler trucks. You know, it was people who were concerned about the environment, people who wanted to be like on the cutting edge of tech. It was a lot of liberals. It was a lot of rich left coast liberals, you know, and other people too. But it was a lot of that. And he has alienated those people completely. So yeah, his sales are dropping. But, you know, I saw one person made a post on Mastodon just a little bit ago, Kasim Rashid, who I forget what exactly he does, but I followed him. He's a human rights lawyer and some other stuff. Ooh. But he posted, look, the fact that Musk has lost about $100 billion over the last month with how the stock market has been doing and Tesla in specific has been doing. But he's still the wealthiest person in the world after losing $100 billion in nominal income. And not only that, but like in terms of his day-to-day life, doesn't even make a difference.
No.
Like lost $100 billion. Like he's, and I'm no longer quoting the tweet, but he's making the point. It's like, because he goes on and talks about there shouldn't be billionaires and all that kind of stuff. And I'm not necessarily one that says we need to tax all billionaires out of existence completely or anything like that. Like maybe I'm not like all billionaires are evil, but at the same time, the notion that he can lose $100 billion, essentially have it not impact his day-to-day life at all, and still be the richest person in the world by a decent margin, is indicative of something.
Yep. On the other hand, if his market keeps going down like it is right now, some of his margin loans are going to get called at some point. And then he may not be the richest.
Yeah, Yvonne has pointed that out a couple times on the Curmudgeon's Corner Slack. I don't know if he mentioned it on the podcast. Yeah. But yeah, apparently Musk is significantly leveraged in certain areas and using his stock as collateral and stuff like that. So there are certain circumstances that could cause a rapid deterioration in his situation. However, I think you can safely say that even in the worst possible case for Elon Musk, he's going to be doing pretty well.
I'm not so sure anymore. There are more than a few billionaires who ended up on the dole in the world.
I don't know. I have trouble envisioning a situation where you end up passing Elon on a street corner, holding up the sign, asking for $5 for dinner. I'm sorry. He will avoid that fate.
Yeah. Except, you know, he's got basically three companies. He's got Tesla, he's got the rocket company, and he's got X. X is worthless. It's still losing. It has paper value, but nothing else. His Tesla stock is what he leveraged to buy X. And the rocket company has now got two spectacular failures in a row. I'm not sure that people are anxious to buy that stock.
Well, that one's private. You can't.
Is that privately owned? Okay.
SpaceX is private. So, but it does. And normally you'd say, well, does this put his government contracts at risk?
Yep.
But in the world we have now, Elon's hanging out in Oval Office every day.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and it has a significant part in the decisions that will influence his company in SpaceX and Tesla too.
Yeah.
So I don't know that you can say, well, clearly NASA's going to cancel the contracts they have, or at least put a hold on it, or put something, you know, maybe not. Apparently even this time, you kind of would have expected that maybe the FAA would have put more restrictions on after that first rocket blew up a month ago that would have prevented the same thing from happening the second rocket. And from what I've seen so far, they're still investigating. It was essentially the same failure that happened a month ago, you know, in terms of what physically happened to the rocket. So they clearly did not take the amount of time necessary to fully address the situation. Now, I'm sure the situation is a little bit different. They probably, you know, but nevertheless, yeah. Who knows? It's probably still full speed ahead in terms of that. Now, the Tesla stuff, on the other hand, you know, unlike SpaceX, where the primary customer is going to be, I mean, there are corporate customers too, but government makes a huge part of SpaceX's plans. Tesla, you have to get people to buy the damn cars. And if less and less people want the cars, that's a problem for you. Now, can Musk at some point sort of make up the people he's losing by getting new people excited about the product? Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. Okay. I think that's it, Ed.
Yep. Sounds
good. Thank you for joining us yet again, Ed. And we hope to see you again. You know, when I invite people, when I need a co-host and I invite people, I always exclude the last few people. Like Bruce did not get an invite here because he did it last time. You know, he did it only a few weeks ago. Ed now will not get an invite the next couple of times that we have an opening, but you know, he'll eventually come back around. I do that to try to enforce some variety, because for a while it was just like Ed and Bruce and Ed and Bruce and Ed and Bruce and Ed and Bruce, and they're the only ones we ever got on. But and it still kind of is. You two are my two most common co-hosts by a long margin. But but I you know, some variety is good too. But
maybe the next time I do it, I'll draft my son-in-law to come and join. We can have a three-way again.
There you go. But yeah, no, it's a lot of fun to have you, and we really appreciate it when you do it. So thank you for coming, Ed.
My pleasure.
For everyone listening, have a great week. Stay safe. Have fun, but not too much fun. And and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thanks again, Ed, and you know, stay healthy, and we'll talk to you next time.
Okay. Always a pleasure.